Superfan, you visit the hometown of your idol and buy a sweatshirt with the name of their high school. Stalker, you visit the hometown of your idol and walk the halls of their high school while wearing a mask made out of human skin.
Superfan, you see your idol at the movies, and as they exit the theater, you ask for a picture. Stalker, you see your idol at the movies, so you have a friend pose as a theater employee, directing them to a special seat. The special seat is you dressed as a seat.
Superfan, you have jury duty and learn that your idol's cousin is the prosecuting attorney, so you excuse yourself from the jury for potential bias, but only after taking a selfie with the cousin. Stalker, you have jury duty and learn that your idol's cousin is the prosecuting attorney, so you trade your swing vote, condemning an innocent man to a life sentence in exchange for your idol's garage code.
Superfan, you send a handwritten letter to your idol detailing the ways in which they have changed your life for the better. Stalker, you attach a handwritten letter to the windshield of your idol's car, but then you discover that the door is unlocked and you decide to bed down in the back seat for the night. The next day, you stay completely silent as your idol runs errands around town. 4 hours in, as the sweat from your body begins to overwhelm the car's Orange Dream air freshener, you begin to imitate the middle-aged British voice on the GPS and miraculously navigate your idol out to the desert where you've constructed a 25-foot-tall sand sculpture of the two of you embracing. And if you do it again, Terry, we'll have to press charges. Chapter 15.
Conduct a weird experiment.
Experimentation and discovery have always been two major pillars of our friendship. Decades before we conducted the psychopath smell test, tried to give ourselves the hiccups, or wondered, will it shoo, on Good Mythical Morning, we were conducting amateur experiments within the confines of Buies Creek. Without smartphones or the internet to enchant us, we were left with our own curiosity.
Our pseudo-scientific career began with a cloud of smoke. One afternoon, when we were about 10, we were standing in my garage watching my rock tumbler. This was a favorite pastime of mine. I couldn't actually see the rocks themselves, just the red cylinder that slowly turned them over and over, but I could hear the rocks tumbling inside. It was mesmerizing to me. Rhett, not so much. After about 20 minutes or so, he couldn't take it anymore and asked if I had any matches. I reminded him of the many times Smokey the Bear had implored us not to play with matches, but he wasn't having it. Rhett explained that Smokey the Bear wasn't an actual bear, just a man in a bear suit with a puppet mouth. Look, he said, we weren't going to be lighting matches in a forest, Smokey's primary area of expertise and concern. We would stay on my deck, where the trees were already dead. Plus, Smokey the Bear commercials were for kids who aren't careful. Made sense to me. I went to the forbidden kitchen drawer and grabbed a box of matches. Walking the matches outside, I couldn't completely shake the image of Smokey the man in a bear costume standing disapprovingly with his arms crossed. So I insisted that we immediately throw the matches into an old Coke bottle after striking them. Rhett thought that I was being too careful, but reluctantly agreed.
This is probably an appropriate time for me to step in and mention that my attitude towards Smokey the Bear has softened considerably with age. While I still suspect that he's not a real bear, I feel his mission is a worthy one, and his advice to not play with matches is sound. I'm also reasonably sure he is not a fan of deck fires, which we could have easily started that day.
We then took turns striking matches. The match striker would hold up his freshly lit stick like the Statue of Liberty while the other guy watched in awe. Again, kids were easily impressed pre-internet. Then, just before the flame reached our fingers, we would toss the matches into the bottle. We quickly burned through most of our matches, and I explained to Rhett that I didn't think it would be wise to confiscate another box. My stepdad, Jimmy, probably wouldn't notice one missing, but two would be pushing our luck. So, we struck our last few matches with extra special care, cherishing the majesty of each flame. And because we were trying to milk every ounce of entertainment value out of each match, we paid close attention as we tossed them into the bottle, which is when we noticed that the entire bottle would fill with smoke when a match was extinguished. "We should trap the smoke," Rhett said excitedly. I agreed. We took our last two matches, lit them together, tossed them into the bottom of the bottle, then grabbed the top and screwed it down tightly. We leaned in to investigate, and inside the bottle hung a thick gray haze, perfectly suspended in midair. We had trapped the smoke. We set the bottle on the back deck. Rhett slept over that night, and we returned to the bottle to check in on our smoke-trapping experiment a good 20 times. For all we knew, this experiment had never been done before, certainly not by children. Surely we would gain some sort of renown for our research. We could see the headlines in the local paper. And scientific first, local boys trap smoke. We went to sleep that night wondering what state our experiment would be in the next morning. I awoke at the first sign of daylight and poked Rhett's sleeping bag. After a couple of groggy seconds, his face lit up. Smoke bottle! We sprang up and ran down the hallway like it was Christmas morning. The bottle sat in the morning light, filled with that same gray haze as the night before. The smoke had been trapped forever. Then it hit us. We could unscrew the top and watch the smoke escape the bottle. We had nothing to lose. We could always just trap more smoke. I grabbed the bottle and slowly unscrewed the cap. We both sat in anticipation and waited for the smoke to billow out of our bottle like a chimney. But nothing happened. I looked down into the bottle and all I saw was a pile of expired matches. I was confused because smoke was clearly visible from the outside of the bottle. Turns out the smoke had created a gray film on the inside of the bottle, merely giving it the appearance of being trapped. While disappointed that our bottle didn't spew smoke like exhaust from a big rig, we were equally fascinated with what we had learned. Smoke wasn't a gas. It was just a collection of fine particles left over after something burns. It was more like a dust. We were officially scientists.
Our affinity for experimentation and discovery carried through to high school. One of our classmates and friends, Jeff Autry, was a self-described good old boy from a farming family. His tractor accident stories were far more captivating than AP European history, but he particularly sparked our interest when he revealed that he knew how to make homemade wine. Neither Link nor I drank alcohol while in high school, but I still begged Jeff to share his secret recipe. I was gripped by the thought that I could simply follow a series of steps and create a consumable alcoholic beverage. Jeff smiled at my request, scribbled a set of instructions on a sheet of notebook paper, and handed it to me. As I hid it in my pocket, he said, "If you don't follow this exactly, you might go blind." A look of concern sprouted on Link's face. I, on the other hand, was sold. The possibility of me and Link losing our eyesight only enhanced my interest in the process. In an effort to curb the potential proliferation of winemaking among mythical beasts, I will refrain from sharing Jeff's recipe here. All you need to know is that the recipe was remarkably simple and had a line that read, "Add your fruit of choice." While one might assume that the best fruit of choice for a first-time winemaker would be grapes, it's important that you know that country singer Deanna Carter had recently released her hit single, Strawberry Wine, and the song was very popular at Harnett Central High School. Even though Deanna's song was about losing her innocence in the woods, we were subliminally compelled by the fact that we, just like the girl in the song, were 17. In a sense, we were also losing our innocence in that we would be manufacturing an alcoholic beverage without a proper license. The choice had been made for us. Our wine would be strawberry. However, we also wanted to maintain some sense of originality. I asked Jeff, "Do you think we could add bananas?" He looked at me and said, "Well, it ain't yogurt, but I guess it won't hurt." That's all I needed to hear. Since Link was a little apprehensive about this entire endeavor, we decided to manufacture the wine in my upstairs bathroom. When my mom saw us ascending the stairs with a 2-liter of Coke, a basket of strawberries, a bunch of bananas, and an entire 1-pound bag of sugar, she started to ask what we were up to. Before she could even finish the question, I calmly said, "We're going to eat some fruit and have some Coke upstairs. Link likes sugar on his strawberries." She knew something else was going on, but probably also figured it couldn't be too nefarious based on the ingredients. She simply returned a skeptical, "Okay." Once the secret recipe had been executed, we had to find a good spot to store our homebrew so it could ferment. I didn't exactly want to carry our bottle of pre-wine around the house, so I determined that the best place for fermentation would be on top of the AC unit inside the storage closet in the bathroom. My parents never went in there, and I could easily check on the concoction from the privacy of my own bathroom. As the weeks passed, the intensity of the very obvious alcohol smell grew. It's difficult to communicate just how exciting this was. We had simply followed Jeff's advice and now there was a metabolic process happening in my bathroom whereby bacteria was consuming sugar and converting it into alcohol. I felt like a mad scientist. At the same time, I was a bit worried about whether the AC was blowing the smell of strawberry banana wine all over the house, but my parents never said a word. When it appeared that the fermentation process was complete, I filtered the sweet tonic and called Link to let him know the wine was ready. We decided that it didn't seem right to just stand in a bathroom and drink wine together. After all, this would be the first time either of us would be consuming alcohol, and it wasn't just any alcohol. It was our special alcohol. We had made it, and it might make us go blind. We decided to plan a camping trip so that we could drink our homemade wine on the banks of the Cape Fear River. As with the song Strawberry Wine, we were likely influenced by country songs that caused us to think all significant life events happen on riverbanks. The next Friday night, we laid out our sleeping bags under the stars at a small sandy patch right next to the water. The location was remote, dramatic, and beautiful. The perfect spot for what we anticipated would be our passing from boyhood into manhood. I had removed the plastic bottle's label so our special hooch could easily be seen in all of its cloudy pinkish-brown glory. We waited until the sky turned dark and the large southern moon floated above us, shedding a blue light on our illicit ceremony. When we unscrewed the top, the unmistakable sweet smell of fermented strawberries and bananas filled the campsite. Link volunteered, "You go first." He was still consumed by the thought of us going blind and being stuck in the woods with no hope of finding our way back home. At least he could leave me out if he kept his vision. I slowly brought the bottle to my lips, tipped it back, and let the fruits of our labor fill my mouth. Once my tongue had a chance to process this strange new beverage, it sent my brain a very clear message. "You're drinking rotten Kool-Aid." I tightly closed my lips, determined to swallow it. I was not about to spew our precious creation into the river. After a few seconds of breathing through my nose to regain my composure, I force-swallowed our special strawberry banana wine. The aftertaste was even worse. I conjured up a smile and held the bottle out to Link. He just sat there and stared, waiting for me to go blind. A few minutes passed. I hadn't vomited or lost my sight, so Link bravely took a sip, going through the same process of overcoming his body's insistence that he not swallow the potentially poisonous liquid he had just put in his mouth. He shot me a smile that was more of a grimace and handed back the bottle. Without speaking, we passed the sauce back and forth a few times, hoping that our palates would acclimate to the sugary battery acid. They didn't. We eventually gave up and resealed the container and sat silently on the banks of the Cape Fear with a sense of accomplishment and nausea. We felt like men.
We never finished that bottle, but we did go on to make additional batches of wine, eventually using grapes. I even got to a point where I was willing to ferment it in the crawl space of my house. We never made anything worth drinking, but again, it was less about the product and more about the process. We learned something every time we adjusted an element of the technique. When we started Good Mythical Morning, we knew that experiments would be an integral part of the show because experimentation starts with a sense of curiosity. Mythicality is characterized by wanting to find answers to questions. Granted, our questions are not always very sophisticated. The Willet series is based on trying to find out if certain unexpected food combinations will end up being a pleasant surprise. Learning that toothpaste doesn't pair well with pancakes isn't necessarily as groundbreaking as finding the cure for the common cold, but it's more fun and much less expensive. Good Mythical Experiments.
We've satisfied our curiosity by asking a number of questions on GMM. Here are some of our favorites.
Psychopath Smell Test, Episode 167. Question: who is more of a psychopath? Background: a study suggested that psychopaths have below-average senses of smell. Experiment: while blindfolded, Rhett and Link each smelled a series of items, including, among other things, markers, pickles, and beef jerky. Conclusions: Link is more of a psychopath, but it's close. Rhett thinks cookie dough smells like dog food. Link thinks ground red pepper smells like shoes. Link still has Yoo-Hoo at the forefront of his memory.
Never Wet Our Pants, Episode 350. Question: is it possible to use waterproofing spray to make completely stain and water-resistant clothing? Background: Never Wet Spray claims to waterproof everything it's sprayed on. Experiment: Rhett served as the control group, wearing unsprayed white clothes. Link's clothes were sprayed with Neverwet. Then they both applied wine, barbecue sauce, and mustard to the clothes. Conclusions. Neverwet, when applied to clothing, actually does work. It repels most liquid, causing them to visibly roll up into balls on the clothing and fall off. The process of watching liquids and sauces bounce off Link's clothes caused Rhett to achieve unnecessary levels of excitement that are not becoming of respectable scientific experimentation.
Testing Mercury in retrograde, episode 761. Question: does Mercury being in retrograde really bring bad luck? Background: the nature of Mercury's solar orbit in respect to Earth's results in an optical illusion that it is moving backwards. This is the period in which Mercury is said to be in retrograde. It is purported that there are a number of actions that will have negative outcomes if performed during this time, including making an agreement, starting a business, launching a website, and making large purchases. Experiment. While Mercury was in retrograde, Link agreed to never use Rhett's lip balm again, therein revealing that he had been using Rhett's lip balm, a disclosure made more significant by the fact that Link has herpes. Rhett and Link started a business and website and won, tootcrate.com, where customers could buy flatulence, and they purchased a NASCAR-themed computer off of Craigslist from a man in North Carolina. Conclusions. Tootcrate probably isn't a desirable subscription service. Tootcrate.com, WeFartInJars.com, RipItAndShipIt.com, and PootCrate.com were all available domain names. People in North Carolina who own NASCAR-themed PCs don't know what Mercury in retrograde means.
Can You Smell Fear? Episode 614. Question. Is it possible for Rhett and Link to determine if the other is experiencing fear or happiness by only smelling them? Background. One scientific study determined that smelling the sweat of another person can indicate that person's level of fear. Experiment. Rhett and Link were each subjected to things that they are traditionally frightened of, or alternatively, things that make them happy. For Rhett, fears included heights and roaches, and for Link, a fear was crew member Chase dressed like a psycho killer. Link was also subjected to something that traditionally makes him happy, a bowl of frosted mini-wheats. Rhett and Link smelled each other's armpits after each item was introduced. Conclusions. Rhett and Link cannot smell fear. They were wrong 100% of the time. Link's armpits smell really bad without deodorant, especially the left one. Rhett's armpits are at perfect smelling height for Link. Link's science project, Nature in the Balance.
My 8th grade science project was a jarring experience for me, literally. I filled 8 jars with water, added in various combinations of a water weed, Elodea, and snails, Gastropoda, and sealed all the lids. And then I watched. I was determined to answer the pressing question plaguing all of mankind. What magical combination of weeds and snails doesn't turn into a putrid brown mess after 3 weeks? My hypothesis? This is blue ribbon material. It turned out to be red ribbon material thanks to Sam Cluck's analysis of Drosophila fly reproduction that I swear his parents did for him, but whatever. Here's some excerpts from my log, chronicling the sad downward spiral of nature happening in my garage. Day 1, January 26, 1989, 6:55 p.m. Jar number 4. Snails are alive, but one is floating on top. Plants are alive. Water is clear. Day 7, February 1, 1989, 5:59 p.m. Jar number 4. One snail appears to be dying. Plants are dying. Water is clear. Day 21, February 14th, 1989, 9:55 p.m. Jar 4. Snails are dead. Plants are dead. Water is brown.
Chapter 16.
Throw a party that doesn't suck.
Parties are supposed to be awesome. A time to get together with the right people in the right place and have fun. When people want to celebrate appreciation, inauguration, coronation, graduation, procreation, and a whole lot of other words that end in -ation, they throw a party. But if parties are supposed to be among the highlights of our lives, then why is it that they are, more often than not, a total letdown?
One fine day in June, my mom asked me to get into the car and then wrapped a t-shirt around my face to blindfold me. I was an anxious 9-year-old, so this didn't exactly set my mind at ease. Why is Mom blindfolding me? Is she really my mom? Could she be an alien, secretly monitoring my way of life all this time? Am I going to be ground up into pet food for alien pets? Is this really how it all ends? Sensing my concern, she assured me that we were going someplace fun. Remember, she said, today's your birthday. As we zoomed down winding country roads, my anxiety was replaced with car sickness. I wanted out. No surprise was worth this much suffering. My mom continued to comfort me, assuring me, Rhett will be there. Didn't help. She broadened her promise to, all your friends and family will be there. Still sick. Finally, she revealed, we're having a party at one of your favorite places. None of this caused my nausea to subside. In retrospect, the blindfold had been rendered mostly unnecessary, seeing as she had disclosed a significant number of pertinent details leading to one inevitable conclusion. She was taking me to a surprise birthday party. But, determined to keep at least the location a surprise, my mom insisted that I keep my 100% cotton veil on while she kept winding down the road. Mom, I think I'm going to barf, I said. We're almost there, she assured me. It's going to be great. All I could think about was how not great it was going to be to throw up into a t-shirt tied around my face. Then, at the moment I was convinced that I couldn't hold it any longer, the car came to a stop. Can I take off the t-shirt now? I asked. No, she snapped. She came around and opened the door, took my hand, and escorted me across a parking lot and into somewhere with a familiar smell. When she removed my blindfold, there they were, all my family and friends sitting in McDonald's. They began to yell, surprise! But then quickly lost confidence and volume once they saw my pale face. It came out as more of a surprise that trailed off as I bolted for the bathroom. My mom never blindfolded me again. Come to think of it, she hasn't even really surprised me since. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's been party to a party that turns sour. In fact, I'm convinced that pretty much every party suffers from the same problem. People have a tendency to bring unrealistic expectations to them. When they hear the word party, they think, it's going to be great, which means that, most likely, it's going to be a disappointment.
One of the most highly anticipated parties of my life was at Red Foo's house. He was a guest on an episode of GMM, and after the show, he invited me and Link to a party the following week. We were excited. This dude has a song called Party Rock Anthem, and his house is called the Party Rock Mansion. I could only imagine the extreme party shenanigans we would experience, the kinds of things you only see at parties in the movies, where the cops show up, and they're so entranced by the vibe that they come inside and begin performing perfect renditions of the YMCA dance. I fully expected that they would be serving sushi right off of people's bodies, and that we would eventually get into a hot tub full of Jell-O. I wouldn't have been surprised if there had been a caged bear on display, a flaming couch being tossed out a window, and at least one person getting stabbed. I was ready for a party. But when we showed up, there were no cops banging on the front door, and no smoldering sofa sitting on the front lawn. There was just a nice man out front asking to see our IDs. Upon entering, we were asked to remove our shoes. This was less like dropping into an epic party and more like entering the home of an elderly couple who wants to preserve their new carpet. We noticed that there was a pair of very flashy canvas van shoes on each step of the stairs. We figured, oh, this is why we had to take our shoes off. So we each squeezed tightly into a pair of size 10 Vans. They were all size 10, and moved deeper into the party. It didn't take long to notice that no one else was wearing shoes. It turns out that the Vans were just Red Foo's personal shoe collection, not something he intended for partygoers to wear. But at that point, we were committed. Inside, no one was eating sushi off of anyone's body, and there were no caged bears, and not one person was being assaulted. There were just a bunch of cool-looking people talking to one another. We went out back, and the hot tub was full of water, not Jell-O. We returned inside, where people were now dancing in their socks, and saw Red Foo. It was hard to hear him over the music, but he seemed to say, thanks for coming, and then looked down at our feet and chuckled a little as if to say, why are you wearing my shoes? Given that we didn't really know anyone else, and that my size 12 feet were really beginning to feel the effects of walking around in Redfoo's size 10 shoes, we made a few more rounds, snapped some pictures in the photo booth, and decided to head home. It wasn't that the party was lame. It was that it was just a party.
We have developed a theory that the natural momentum of every party moves towards suckage. This is due not only to the fact that we typically bring unrealistic expectations to them, but also because it only takes one miscalculated party factor to create a forgettable experience. What's the answer? Just give up and cease partying? Far from it. Parties are planned moments of celebration. They present opportunities for highly concentrated mythicality. We owe it to our species to get this right, because humans are destined to continue throwing parties until we die out and are replaced with cockroaches. Cockroaches may then evolve the ability to party, and assuming that they will also evolve the ability to read 21st century English, and one of them will find this book in the distant future, they are invited to take note as well.
While you can't do much to shape the parties you attend, you do have control over the parties that you personally throw. The most important rule of parties is, parties are only as good as the planning. If your party sucks, it's probably your fault. The following are a number of the party pitfalls we've witnessed, along with some proposed solutions designed to ensure maximum mythicality at your next soiree.
Party pitfall number one, incorrect friend-to-stranger ratio. Nothing kills party potential like the wrong ratio of friends to strangers. If you don't know anyone, you end up like us at Redfoo's house, walking around with the person you came with, talking only about the lack of Jell-O in the hot tub. It's pathetic. On the other hand, if you know everyone, you're forced to hear your friends Doug and Allison tell their finding true love at a Fish concert story for the 12th time. We get it, Allison. You love a man who can handle his hacky sack. Tip. A good ratio of friends to strangers is 60-40. This gives you the comfort of knowing you can connect with friends, but you still have the opportunity to get to know someone new, hopefully someone who isn't a Fish fan. How do you get people you don't know at your own party? Tell your friends to bring friends. Duh. We've been looking for an excuse to use duh this entire book. Please forgive us.
Party pitfall number two. Wrong kinds of people. In our opinion, a mythical party is one where the guests stand a good chance of getting into an interesting conversation, and that usually involves learning something new from someone with a unique perspective. If you're a proctologist and you go to a proctology conference, no doubt there's going to be some kind of party at the hotel restaurant, most likely featuring a pianist playing Journey songs. And at that party, you're going to end up talking to a bunch of buttholes about buttholes. Yawn. Tip. The key is to invite the kinds of people who would make great Reddit Ask Me Anything hosts, like an exterminator or an ER doctor. These people have seen unspeakable things in unspeakable places, and they're dying to speak about them in a casual setting.
Party pitfall number three, food faux pas. Never, under any circumstances, throw a party without food. Even if all your friends are on weird diets that preclude them from eating anything other than specially prepared meals they carry around in their own Tupperware, this is much more common in Los Angeles than you might expect, serve food. People on fun-free diets are known to relax their standards at parties, and famished people are incapable of sustaining positive party vibes. Tip. The overarching solution for party food is heavy hors d'oeuvres. The one question everyone asks themselves prior to attending a party is, should we eat before? Heavy hors d'oeuvres answers that question regardless of the decision your attendees made. And, although hors d'oeuvres is a fancy term, they themselves don't have to be fancy. Meatballs are perfect. When the meatballs come out, everyone will be happy. Even people stuck in conversations about Fish with Doug and Allison. Just make sure you provide enough, because you don't want your guests to suffer from anticipated meatball disappointment, the acute condition of watching some jerk eat the last meatball. In an ideal party world, you're sending people home with baggies of meatballs.
Party pitfall number four, boredom. A mythical party has no lulls. You have to be ready for the real possibility of conversation tapering off by providing activities to keep people engaged. These should be optional, though, because you don't want to be the party dictator who forces everyone into a 40-person game of Twister. Although we have seen this done to great success with minimal injury, and it spawned at least one marriage. Tip. You want simple activities that are fun to do and entertaining for spectators. Avoid horseshoe tournaments. They are not only boring, but dangerous. While conversational games like Two Truths and a Lie, or its more time-consuming cousin, Three Truths and Two Lies, can be perfect in the right crowd, providing a competitive team game is often the best strategy. We recommend Hide the Meatball.
Here are the rules for Hide the Meatball. Object: be the last team standing by finding your opposing team's meatballs. Step 1. Divide into two teams of equal size. Name your teams because it's fun. If your party size is uneven, have one person play the talker. Step 2. Each team picks up one meatball. Take note of who chose the larger meatball. Step 3. Each team turns away from the opposing team, at which point one player on each team is selected to place a meatball in his or her mouth, but does not chew or otherwise consume it. Step 4. Each team turns back toward the other when the talker says so. If there is no talker, it may be hard to determine when to turn around, but you'll figure it out.
Step 5. The team, in this example, Team 1, that chose the larger meatball goes first. Using only grunts and gestures, Team 1 must agree on choosing one player from the opposing team that they think has the meatball in his or her mouth. Step 6. The accused player opens his or her mouth. Step 7. If Team 1 guessed correctly, the person with the meatball eats it and is eliminated, sits out. Team 1 then turns away in order for one of the remaining members to secretly take a meatball. Play continues to Team 2. If the opposing team guesses incorrectly, they must eliminate someone on their own team who does not currently possess their meatball. Play continues for Team 2. Step 8. Play continues until the losing team is entirely eliminated or everyone gets tired of eating meatballs.
Party pitfall number 5, the dwindle. Known in some circles as the fizzle, this is the inevitable waning to lameness to which parties seem to be ultimately doomed. It can be signaled in a number of ways, such as the DJ restarting his playlist, the cool people beginning to leave, or you finding yourself in a corner alone, nibbling on a cold meatball. This is not how you want your guests to remember your party. Instead, you want to abruptly end it just after a peak, before any hint of the dwindle. Tip: we advise that you let people know up front, either using several large signs placed throughout the venue or on the invitation, if applicable, that the party is over when a particular sound is heard. We've found that an air horn works in almost every environment. It can't be mistaken for a doorbell, a phone ringing, or a fire alarm, and it easily pierces through even the loudest pumping bass. As the party planner, you are responsible for sensing when to abort, but know this: very few parties have more than 3 peaks. The conservative approach is to sound your horn immediately after the second peak, but you may want to gamble for a third peak because a 3-peak party ended at just the right time is the kind of party that people tell their grandkids about.
If you can avoid these pitfalls at your upcoming party, you will notice that the people who attended will start calling and texting you to ask you when your next bash is. This is a sign that you have indeed thrown a mythical party, and it's a huge accomplishment. We would even go as far as to say that it's a service to humanity.
You see, a party can provide one of those rare moments when you can experience every aspect of mythicality simultaneously. A party can pique your curiosity and make you laugh if the right people are there. A party can bring more good into the world if you're partying to bring awareness or support to a cause. A party can even have a sense of adventure and originality if you choose to do the right activities. Hide the Meatball alone can accomplish this. If you can provide a setting where this kind of mythicality is experienced by a group of people, you're making a difference.
May all your parties be mythical.
Party MVPs and LVPs.
Party MVPs. The one-hit Wanda. This could be the ER doctor who removed a weird something from a weird place on a weird person, the woman who does spot-on Sesame Street impressions, or the Frisbee instructor. You may not want to be their lifelong companion, but they sure make a 10-minute exchange at a party memorable.
No shame, Shane. He'll get everyone on the dance floor, sing the first karaoke song, eat the first hot wing of unknown spiciness, and introduce people who have been staring silently at each other from across the room.
OCD. She can't handle clutter and feels compelled to clean up after everyone, but she isn't obvious or dramatic about it because she's self-conscious about the compulsion.
Game Master Melvin. Who wants to play charades, liar's dice, or set up a ping pong tournament? As long as this person doesn't pressure people to participate, they're great to have around.
Conversation Camille Leon. What you talking about? Herbal remedies? Video games? First kisses? Cool. I got some hilarious but not overbearing thoughts on that.
Holly the Hostess Cupcake. She might not live in the house, and it might not be her birthday party, but her mission in life is to make sure everyone feels included and special. Sure, she can be controlling, but if you just let her play sheepdog, everyone will benefit.
Party LVPs. Epic-er Story Corey. He feels compelled to one-up your amazing story before you've even uttered the last words of said story.
Touchy McFeely with Texty McTexterson. One is way too intimate, the other couldn't be less engaged.
Red Wine Wendy. The Pinot is her permission slip to start keeping it real with her opinions. Glass one. That's an interesting dress. Glass two. Did you make this dip because it tastes weird? Glass three. You guys need to get divorced already.
Tate the Debater. To him, actual arguments are normal conversations, and actual normal conversations are stupid.
And Pyra Mildred Scheme. She's got the perfect products for you to sell to your friends for her.
No budget blowouts.
The global party scene is completely out of control. Million-dollar weddings, kids' birthday parties with swag bags, red carpet retirement parties. Everywhere you look, people are mortgaging their life in order to throw a record-setting shindig that will hopefully induce mass FOMO across their social media networks.
This is all unnecessary. When it comes to throwing a great party, creativity trumps cash every time. To prove it, here are three different themed parties that will wow your friends and generate crazy buzz and, if you want, online FOMO, and they won't cost a thing.
Party number one, post-apocalyptic potluck. The key to this party is that none of the guests eat for 3 days before the event, and then everyone brings unmarked canned foods that the host hides all over the house. Games include, how far will you go for a can opener, celebrity zombie charades, and touch those baked beans and I'll kill you.
Party number two, most satisfying party ever. Have every guest bring their most comfortable clothes and blankets, along with any leftovers they currently have in the fridge. Create a YouTube playlist of a bunch of those most satisfying videos, featuring things like cutting Play-Doh with a knife, fresh pasta squirting out of a machine, or skilled baristas doing incredible latte foam designs, all set to hypnotic music. Have everyone sit back and experience pure, unadulterated satisfaction.
Party number three, Mennonite Out. The Mennonites have a tradition of inviting the community over to build a barn in just a day, called a barn raising. Borrowing from that idea, the Mennonite Out is when you invite your friends over to celebrate a meaningful life event and get them to renovate your garage. Win-win.
Chapter 17.
Risk Your Heart for an Animal.
For thousands of years, human-animal relationships were limited mostly to either humans chasing animals so they could eat them, or animals chasing humans so they could eat them. Then, one glorious day, an especially mythical individual decided that, instead of running from the wolves, we should try to pet them. That person was probably eaten by a wolf. But eventually, when the right person petted the right wolf, it opened the door for a bond that has brought mythicality into millions of people's lives.
Since those early days of wolf petting, humans have gone on to find companionship with thousands of different animals. Even though some people may feel a special connection with an iguana that never makes eye contact or a cobra that can kill you during feeding time, we have found our animal friends in the canine species. Specifically those who have been selectively bred as cute companions we can carry around in a backpack. These are the kinds of dogs that couldn't eat us unless we chopped ourselves up into bite-sized pieces and added real cheese flavor. And they have become members of our families. However, Our journey to this current state of camaraderie with man's best friend was filled with some lowlights. It turns out that choosing to love an animal is not without its risks.
My childhood dog was named Tucker. He was a big, yellowish-brown border collie mix with a head so pointy it was like he had a horn that never quite broke through. Tucker lived outside because in rural North Carolina in the 1980s, that was a dog's proper place. Sure, there were a few families that had house dogs, as we called them, but those were also the families that talked funny and ate lean cuisine. We local folk knew that dogs descended from wild animals, which meant that the backyard would do just fine. As with most things in my life, I had a specific daily routine with Tucker. I would venture out into the backyard, approach his house, and fill his bowl with gravy train. Then I would pet him on his pointy head exactly 5 times. This was definitely an indicator of my future OCD, though I justified it by telling myself that 5 pets allowed me to both bond with Tucker and easily wash the smell of dog off my hands later. We didn't really bathe our dogs back then. As long as they jumped into a creek or pond a couple of times during the summer, we considered them clean. As a result, all backyard dogs achieved a distinct dog smell, and you knew that you'd get it all over you if you petted them too much, more than 5 times. I loved Tucker. As an only child, he was kind of like a brother to me, a really hairy, naked brother who wasn't allowed in the house. Tucker would accompany me on treks through the woods. I felt safe knowing that he could pierce the vital organs of any predator with a swift headbutt from his sharp skull. And Tucker loved me back. He never judged me. He even accepted me in my jams shorts phase, never shunning me no matter how ridiculous the pattern. One day when I was in middle school, I went out to feed Tucker and caress his subdermal horn. But that day, he wasn't standing by the door in anticipation of his 5 head pats. Instead, he was lying down, with his eyes open, stiff as a board. I sat down next to him and cried. My old pointy-headed friend had taken his last ride on the gravy train. I chose not to bother my mom with the news of Tucker's death or with questions about what to do with him. I felt it was my duty to dispose of his body, so I called up Rhett, who soon arrived on his bike, ready to go to work. The idea of simply throwing poor Tucker into a hole in the ground didn't seem right to me, so we found a large box that could serve as a makeshift coffin. Tucker was a pretty big dog, and the only box we could find that would work was a giant refrigerator box. In all likelihood, the cavernous box could have accommodated at least 5 dead Tuckers, but hey, a dead pharaoh got an entire pyramid. We gently placed his stiff body into the box and then carried it to a good burying spot in my backyard. With every step, Tucker slid around in his oversized cardboard sarcophagus. It's worth noting that we didn't say a word to each other throughout this entire process. It just seemed right to remain silent out of respect for Tucker. We dug for hours until we reached some very rocky soil that was impossible to break up with a shovel. We had excavated a large cube of earth and, using only a series of hand motions to communicate, decided to place the giant box into the hole to see if it would fit. It didn't. The top of the box was sticking about 6 inches out of the ground. Knowing that we had dug as deep as we were capable of, Rhett looked at me and, maintaining his stoic expression, placed his foot on top of the box, then raised his eyebrows as if to ask, "Is it okay if I step on the box?" Seeing no other option, I somberly nodded. I silently joined him, pushing the box down until the crumpled coffin sat about a foot below the surface. We then proceeded to cover it with dirt. Just as the dirt level was getting even with the surface, there was a sudden crashing noise as the top of the box gave way even more, dropping down another few inches. We looked at the hole, looked at each other, looked at the pile of dirt beside us, and then kept shoveling. A few minutes later, the box failed again, and this time we heard the sound of dirt pouring into the box with Tucker. It wasn't exactly a comforting sound, but we continued to add more dirt. Had we been burying a human in this way at some sort of graveside service, the entire family would have been crying and gasping with each audible collapse of the cardboard box. But this was our first burial. We tried our best, and while we didn't find a perfect coffin, dig a fitting hole, or deliver articulate eulogies, I did run inside and grab my trumpet so I could play taps. Ultimately, I'm proud of the way my friend and I worked through broken hearts to honor that pointy-headed pooch. My mom and I never got another dog.
I had two backyard dogs during my childhood who, like Tucker, taught me about both love and loss, or more specifically, love and lost. My first dog was Sandy, an extraordinarily sweet but stupid mutt. She was my parents' answer to their son's endless pleas for dog ownership. I'd always dreamed of having a dog that I could teach a bunch of cool tricks, like having it fetch a cold Dr. Pepper out of the fridge when I licked my lips. Unfortunately, Sandy only ever learned one trick, and that was running away like a prison escapee every time she got a chance. One day when my dad was taking Sandy to the vet in Dunn, she caught him daydreaming about Matlock and bolted past him as soon as he opened the minivan door. She ran behind the Belk department store and we never saw her again. I was devastated. Where had she gone? Did she finally find that new family she'd been searching for? For years, every time we went to Belk, I would walk around the back hoping I might find Sandy curled up in a pair of 30% off pleated khakis, but she was never there. I guess my parents sensed their son's grief because it didn't take long for them to bring home a small black lab mix. We named her Black Beauty. I'm not sure why my family chose the name since we had never read the book Black Beauty or seen the movie. All I know is that after a few awkward instances of having to call her Black Beauty in front of strangers, we shortened her name to Beauty and never spoke of it again. The early days with Beauty were promising. She wasn't constantly trying to run from us like Sandy. But when we decided to bring her out with us to pick peaches at a local orchard, she vanished. We searched for her for hours, and I cried as we drove home empty-handed. My parents told me that they suspected that she had been stolen, which instilled in me a deep distrust of peach farmers that I still carry to this day. These two deeply unsettling dog disappearances in my childhood left me hesitant to get a dog as an adult. Even if a third dog didn't vanish, I knew I was going to outlive another little creature I loved. What kind of sense does that make? Why begin a relationship that you know is going to come to a tragic end? This defensive strategy kept me and Jesse from getting a dog after we got married. But fate wouldn't allow me to go on without a dog. While driving through the town of Irwin in 2003, I decided to stop and grab a bite to eat. I took my lunch down to the Cape Fear River where Link and I made lots of childhood memories. While I ate, a tiny puppy emerged from the woods, walked over, and crawled up in my lap. Seriously. Any commitment that I had to remaining petless melted. I looked around to make sure that she hadn't just wandered off from a peach-picking family, but it was soon obvious that she had been abandoned. We named her Gypsy, and once she made it through puppyhood, I started to feel like my dog curse had been reversed. Wrong. When she was only a little over a year old, Gypsy jumped a fence when we were staying at the beach and was hit by a car and instantly killed. Jessie was pregnant with our first child, Locke, at the time, and Gypsy's death didn't help her already emotionally fragile state. We both sat in the bed and cried. My heart had been crushed again. I told myself, for real this time, I would never own another dog. My wife's parents' dog, Rosie, had other plans. Specifically, she had plans to break out of the house and explore the neighborhood in order to make a canine love connection. That tendency to roam, coupled with Rosie's still very functional reproductive organs, created the perfect storm. Long story short, Rosie hooked up with Sparky, a vicious little chihuahua who spent most of his time tied up to a stake in his owner's backyard. Rosie and Sparky's passionate liaisons produced a litter of the cutest puppies I'd ever seen. I actually filmed Rosie's delivery and instantly fell in love with the run of the litter. Thus, even though Jesse and I were 1 month away from having our second child, we found ourselves in possession of another dog. We knew our baby would be a boy and had decided on the name Shepherd. Since our son was already going to have a dog's name, we determined the dog needed a human name, so we named it Merle. I'd always wanted to name a dog after Merle Haggard, and even though the puppy was a girl, we went for it. We called her Merle the Girl, and we even let her stay in the house. It wasn't exactly easy having a 5-year-old, a newborn, and a puppy under one roof, but we were happy, until another dog convinced Merle to drink our neighbor's antifreeze. I found them both lying lifeless in a yard a few houses down the block. I was a wreck. Clearly, I was cursed. Dogs weren't safe with me. Every relationship I had with them had ended in tragic tears. But then I moved to Los Angeles. For our first 5 years in L.A., we rented a house and the landlord didn't allow pets. Even though my kids begged me every year to get a dog, I would say, "We're not allowed to get a dog. Maybe when we get our own house." When we finally did get our own place, and my excuse evaporated, I tried to convince myself that I wasn't the root cause of the canine curse. Maybe it was a regional thing. Maybe the curse stayed in North Carolina. This is the West Coast. Dogs are different here. You don't keep them in roughshod houses in the backyard. They get baths and haircuts and dress up as Yoda for Halloween. Plus, there's no such thing as curses. After a long break from dog ownership, I told my family that we could get a dog.
What Rhett might not have fully realized at the time is that he was making a dog decision for me as well. You see, our wives and kids are close friends, and we have to take those relationships into account whenever either family makes a major change, like getting an Xbox, another newborn, or a puppy. When Rhett gave his family the green light for a dog, he simultaneously put me in a trap. I had always thought that we just weren't going to be a dog family. Over the course of 15 years of marriage and 3 kids, I had already seen enough poop and vomit from human children to last a lifetime. Plus, every time I thought about having my own dog, I pictured Tucker and heard echoes of his cardboard casket collapsing. But I also saw an opportunity to be a hero. I knew my kids would be thrilled if I were to come home and say, "Hey kids, guess what? We're getting a dog." So, before Rhett even had a chance to get a dog for his family, I got one for mine. My pet adoption scenario is outlined explicitly as what not to do in all of those books you're supposed to read before you get a dog. Just a couple of days after telling my kids they could finally have a dog, my family and I walked past a pen full of pooches in need of rescue at the local farmer's market. My daughter Lily, seizing the opportunity, ran up to the pen and knelt down. A ridiculously cute little black dog walked right up to her and started licking her hand. "Dad, she chose me," she said. We brought Jade, a miniature Dachshund Papillon mix, home with us that day. It's hard to believe that I was considering never getting a dog for my family. Christy and the kids love that little dog, and she has more than won me over too. When she crawls up into my lap, there's a connection that's even stronger than the one I felt every time I petted Tucker's horn, and I pet her way more than 5 strokes a day. It might border on unhealthy. And while she occasionally poops on the rug and licks her privates in front of guests, she's a family member.
Link's hair trigger acquisition of Jade put the pressure back on me. After all, I was the one who had promised my family a new furry sibling, and all of a sudden the Neils had one and we didn't. Jesse and I found a pet rescue center and learned that they recently had someone bring in a litter of what they thought were multi-poo puppies in need of homes. I dropped Jesse and the kids off at the place and then embarked on a quest to find a parking space, something that can take a while in L.A. By the time I went inside the adoption center, Jesse had a cute little white fur ball sitting in her lap. Even though we went through the motions of acting like we were thoroughly considering whether the dog was right for our family, the decision had been made as soon as the puppy sat in her lap. We named her Barbara Mandrell McLaughlin, to continue our tradition of naming dogs after country singers, and we took her home with us, but not before the people at the center took a picture of us with her for their Facebook page. Apparently their Facebook page is TMZ, because Jesse was alerted by her friends 2 days later that we were featured on the site. Barbara has changed my life more than I anticipated. I was never one to do much baby talk with my actual babies, but the way I talk to Barbara is embarrassing. I hope the public never has to witness it. When she jumps up next to me and begins clawing at my hand until I show her some love, I can't resist it. She's a friend who offers more consistent love and loyalty than most humans are capable of. Sure, maybe she just likes me because I feed her grain-free organic dog food, but I don't care.
Jade and Barbara have captured our hearts and brought joy to our families. However, the sad truth is, even if the McLaughlin curse has been broken and the Neil OCD 5-strokes-only method has relaxed, we will still almost certainly outlive both dogs. However, even with the knowledge that our current canine love affairs are destined to end in one way or another, we've gladly made the mythical choice to put our hearts, and our children's hearts, on the line. We think you should too, unless you're allergic. The story of Craig the Python.
In 2016, we did an episode of GMM featuring special guest Tony Hale called "What Am I Petting?" The gameplay was simple. We, along with Tony, put on blindfolds and had to pet things in order to guess what they were. That's comedy, people. The Mythical crew initially planned to have team member Chase bring in his pet chinchilla, AJ. However, on the day of the shoot, they decided it would be funnier if Link had to pet a snake, given his well-known fear of them that he had demonstrated during a previous episode called Trapped in a Snake Tank.
So, crew members Alex and Lizzie went off to find a snake with only hours before the shoot. Although they were able to return the baby corn snakes used in the earlier episode without incident, the store had a strict no-return policy on the only snake available that day, a python.
They were caught between a rock and a hard place. Alex and Lizzie quickly made up a story on the spot that they were a couple buying a snake for Alex's young cousin, and they wanted to return it if he didn't like it. As convincing as this story surely was, it didn't work, so instead of settling for a chinchilla, they bought the snake, along with all the necessary equipment for keeping it as a pet, and brought him to the set.
We named him Craig, although we're not sure if he's male, and we're not sure how to check for that. So far, he has only made the cleaning lady scream once, and he made an epic appearance on Rhett's neck for an episode of GMM. At this point, the crew has a complicated relationship with Craig.
Alex, I kind of regret lying when we were getting Craig, because every time I go back to that pet store, I keep expecting the guy to ask me how my cousin liked the snake.
Lizzie, I also regret lying when getting Craig, because every time I go back to that store, I keep expecting the guy to ask me how my marriage to Alex is going.
Eddie, Craig and I spend a lot of time together, lounging on the hammock, or just scaring Mike. We're inseparable until it's time to go home after work.
Mike, Craig seems like a chill dude, but Eddie always insists on bringing him over to my desk uninvited, so I do hate him.
Allie, thanks to Craig, I once picked up a bowl with a dead rat in it in the kitchen. It was his food defrosting. I still love him, though, because it wasn't his fault.
Chapter 18.
Isolate yourself with yourself.
Neither one of us has ever had much alone time as adults. We both went directly from living with our families to rooming together in college to getting married and living with our wives. Furthermore, the fleeting moments of solitude we were afforded during our first few years of marriage were quickly eviscerated by the rapid and repeated arrival of baby bundles of joy. As if constant interaction with humans in our houses was not enough, we proceeded to add animals to the mix. Long story short, we are now at the point where our only refuge at home is an unnecessarily long bathroom break, and even that is usually interrupted by a lost tooth or request to murder a spider.
Work offers us no more privacy than home. Most weekdays, we carpool to the office together. When we arrive at our studio, instead of retreating to separate offices for a few minutes of seclusion, we both enter our shared office, just like we've done ever since we started working together. For most of our career, we've had desks that face each other. We even sit at the same desk during every episode of GMM. We spend a lot of time together.
To be clear, we are incredibly thankful for the time we spend with our families. We couldn't imagine our homes not being filled with the sounds of door slams, valuables being broken, and heated arguments about who the dog loves most. Furthermore, we think our professional success is largely related to the amount of time we spent in direct collaboration with each other. But due to our family and work environments, we rarely spend any time truly alone.
It's important for us to get time to ourselves in order to be the mythical husbands, fathers, best friends, and entertainers we need to be. When we get the opportunity to experience moments of pure, unadulterated self-reflection, it can be thoroughly reinvigorating. Ironically, one of our most memorable experiences with isolation occurred on GMM when we entered a sensory deprivation tank, or float tank. By allowing you to float effortlessly in a super buoyant salt solution within a completely dark and silent enclosure, a sensory deprivation tank leaves you utterly alone with nothing but your own thoughts.
There's a dude named Ed not too far from us in L.A. who has a float tank at his house. He also has a t-shirt that says, "Prepare to Evolve," and a wall full of inspirational quotes that include fortune cookie papers he has taken pictures of and printed out much larger than the originals. Bottom line, he seems legit enough to trust. Under Ed's direction, we each disrobed, and then re-robed in actual robes, and prepared for entry.
I went first. Once I leaned back and began to float, I noticed that there was only about an inch of clearance above my head and below my feet, and I was gently but repeatedly floating into the sides of the tank. I was worried that I was, yet again, too tall for something. But as the water settled down, I began to experience something foreign to me. Nothing at all. The lack of stimulation and extreme feeling of disconnection from my environment was a little disconcerting. Then something strange happened. I began to see people. More specifically, I began to see people's faces,